Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, in observance of Martin Luther King's birthday, we'll be revisiting our conversation with Sybil Morial, this time in its entirety. She's the author of Witness to Change, From Jim Crow to Political Empowerment. It's a great pleasure to welcome my guest today, educator and activist Sybil Heidel Morial, the former First Lady of New Orleans. She's written a fascinating memoir called Witness to Change, From Jim Crow to Political Empowerment, a revealing look at her life on the front lines of the civil rights movement. Sybil, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you're going to be one of the guests at this year's National Reading Group Month event, sponsored by the Women's National Book Association at NOMA on October 3rd. And it's so appropriate because I was so charmed to learn that your first real conversation with your husband, Dutch Morial, was at a book group.
Yes.
So what was the book? How did this...
Well, it was W.E.B. Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. And you were attracted to Du Bois's work for a particular reason, weren't you?
Of course. I mean, he was one of the forerunners of equality and urging us to get moving on it and that all of us needed to be involved.
Now, one of the things I love about this book is that it's such a loving portrait of your life within your family, growing up in a particular New Orleans neighborhood that gave you a real sense of belonging. But on the other hand, you were always facing the boundaries of the time in the other parts of the city. What was it like for you to go back and remember those childhood days?
It was sort of bittersweet. It was a carefree life. We went outside to play, you know? And we had a big backyard, and that was the neighborhood playground. But we went outside to play. It was always safe. You know, there were lots of children within a two-block area. And even though the barriers were there in that confined area, it was lovely.
But early on, you were determined to test your strength against a larger world, against a world outside, to travel and to seek your education elsewhere. So you were very adventuresome as a young woman.
I was, and I think the turning point for me in terms of becoming an activist was when I left here to go to school at Boston University. It was my junior year, and I was going north, and the whole environment was different. Mm-hmm. Everything was open, and I just loved it. I just drank it all up. I went to the opera. I went to the pops. I went to museums, which I couldn't do here.
Right.
And so that was when, I guess, the genesis of my looking at the world and knowing that there was more than what I had experienced.
And you got to know some great folks at Boston University. There's a party picture of you with Martin Luther King Jr.
That's right. He was in the graduate school. He's working on his doctorate while I was in the undergraduate school. And of course, the African American network was very tight. We all knew each other through sororities and fraternities, and we socialized together, even though we socialized in the big picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And education was always a calling for you.
Yes.
And that education, it seems to me, led to your activism.
Yes, it did. In fact, this got cut from my book, but when I was in graduate school and teaching at the same time, I was the advisor to the Youth Council of the NAACP. That was the first involvement with an organization. And that was only for a year because the year after I got too busy with my job and my graduate work. But then, you know, that started the wheels turning. Yes, I can be a part of this. And so when I came to New Orleans, it was right after the landmark Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in the public schools. So that was really the engine that drove me.
Mm-hmm. And then you tested enrollment policies at Tulane and Loyola yourself.
Yes. at that book party, I met my husband, Dutch, and that's all we talked about was the Supreme Court decision and what did this mean and when is the change going to come and how is it going to come. And he just said, you know, it's interesting, the Tulane faculty just passed a resolution supporting African Americans attending the school. I said, you know, I can take 6 hours toward my master's degree at another accredited university. I think I'll do that. He said, do it. He was so excited. And that's why I did it. We had no idea what was going to bring about the real change. And so I hung around for a week, and then they asked me to leave.
Isn't that shocking, Neil?
But I knew I would have to leave.
Have they begged you to come back?
No. I went next door to Loyola after, but they said, well, you come back to work on your doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't think so.
Now, your whole family has this legacy of activism, of politics. And we all know that, you know, the old behind every man, there's a successful, you know, woman. And politicians need helpmates in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a woman politician, you've got to have your partner on your side. So talk about your role in that, because you are so diplomatic and so graceful and so thoughtful in this book about what makes politics work, what has to be done, what you felt your contribution was.
You know, it's interesting that later on when I was considering running for mayor,
yes,
I told Clancy Dubose, I said, Clancy, I need a wife.
See?
Somebody has to hold the fort, has to keep things going, has to manage the children and the house. And so that's what I did, along with my career.
Yes.
I was participating by allowing him to be out there.
Mm-hmm. And you were a working mom before being a working mom was
the
standard, you know?
Yes, I was. I was teaching school, and that was really very good for mother because we had summers off, as the children did. Days were not long. We started early, but we got home around 4:30, and so it was a very convenient career for a mother with 5 children.
Right. I know. I'm in awe. Now, I wonder if you talk a little bit about your life since 1989 when your husband died. Mm-hmm. And you faced that challenge that a lot of women, myself included, face of rebuilding a life, mm-hmm, and going on with your family after that. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about how that was for you.
Well, fortunately, after my husband passed away, I still had my career and I was moving on and enjoying it and being challenged. So I did not have an empty space to be depressed. I had to keep going on, and that helped me get through that bad time. And my children were growing up and leaving. I still had those at home. I didn't have time to grieve or to even try to wonder, what am I going to do? I was doing what I did. Yes.
Kids keep you busy no matter how old they are.
Right.
They?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, another one of the things I found fascinating about this book is how far back your family history goes. And in writing this book, you learned some things about your family history, and that led you to Whitney Plantation.
Yes. It's very interesting. In 2007, my paternal family had a reunion. And one of my cousins, he researched our family, and all the while I thought the white part of my family was French, but it happened to be German. So he did this research. But beyond that, when a Whitney plantation was established, John Cummings hired a Senegalese historian who had done his doctorate on the slavery on the German coast.
That's so Dr. Ibrahim Asek, right?
Yes, and he documented all of it. So I know my great-grandfather, one great, Victor, was the son of an African woman and a German, the brother of the mistress of the plantation. And so he was the only child of that union, and he had 8 sons.
Wow.
I am amazed how well they did. Well, I'm amazed that Victor, when he was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, in 8 years he owned land. So that amazes me, because he wasn't literate, because they didn't allow slaves to learn to read. Evidently, he knew how to read, but that was another handicap. So he was a progressive man who made something of himself, and that passed on, that example passed on to his 8 sons, my grandfather's generation.
Wow.
And then there came my father, and they did even better. And then there's my generation. So it's not so far back.
Oh, now, like everyone who writes about New Orleans now, you have to write about Katrina And like so many New Orleanians, you were not spared. And also, Katrina had the incredible effect of getting you really to start working on this book. So you lost everything.
When Katrina came, three of my children lived in New Orleans. And we evacuated to my daughter in Baton Rouge, seven of us and a dog in a not dog-friendly house.
Oh, that's hard.
But we all were flooded. One of my daughters had to demolish a house. It was so totally destroyed. But there were four of us, three of us with the flood and my son with the roof. And so we spent some time with my daughter Cherie in Baton Rouge. But then Monique and Jacques had to come back and find work. There was no more work. They had no home. They were homeless and jobless. And so for a while they lived with friends, were dependent on friends until they could start getting themselves together. In the meantime, I was in Baton Rouge and my house was flooded and my neighborhood was deserted. And so I knew it would be more than 3 days, which is usually what we think when we escape from a hurricane. And so it was quite an adjustment to say, well, wait, I can't go home. Mm-hmm. You know, what am I going to do? So I began to really grieve over my losses, photographs, papers, and began to think about them.
Yes.
And the pleasure came. I thought about them, and I thought about them in detail, one event at a time. And it was just wonderful. And then, so I got on my computer every morning and just brought those memories to life.
Didn't that make you feel better?
Oh, I tell you, I would lie in bed at night thinking of one particular event, you know, all the details, what was going on, what time of year was it, you know, what did my mother say, and then I'd get up the next morning and put it on the computer. It was almost like a dream, but I was not dreaming. Mm-hmm. It was a nice note to go to sleep on.
Yes. Well, you said earlier when we were talking, you said I gathered my moments of joy, which is a wonderful thing for writing to do, isn't it?
Yes, but there were also sad times.
Yes.
And I put those down too. But I always told my children, I said, you know, adversity strengthens character. And they would look at me and say, how?
As children do.
Does. When you're past that, you've learned from it. And then you savor the good times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, you know, writing a book, especially writing a memoir, it's always an act of claiming your own history. And you're claiming your place in history. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, when you look back at the arc of your life, it must seem remarkable to you.
Well, I think there are many people whose lives are reflective of mine. They just haven't written it. And then I thought, my generation, they're passing on. And they didn't tell the story. And they didn't write the story. So we're losing some very wonderful stories of those times.
Tell us about some of the fights you're proudest of engaging in.
I had a friend from New York who was a member of the League of Women Voters. And we chatted. And they had a voter registration effort. And that was something I wanted to be involved in. She said, oh, well, I'm going to bring your name up. Now, she's from New York, so she didn't know the state laws. She came back to me and says, the state laws won't allow you to join any organization. So that was the impetus. I said, you know, we can do this. Women like me with young children, we can control the time when we get involved. And we did. The Louisiana League of Good Government was founded. And we went to the neighborhoods to go through the very ordeal of becoming a registered voter.
Yes.
And it was horrible because you had to have the correct identification and they would change it on you. You had to pass a citizenship test. You had to pass a literacy test. And the deputy registrars really were challenging. They tried to humiliate you, mm-hmm. to discourage you. And so we did that for 3 years until the Voting Rights Act was passed. But that was a very rewarding time because I came to know people of little means, but people who were not highly educated, but who wanted their voice heard. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be a part. And that was a wonderful experience for me.
I'm lucky for all of us that you did that. Mm-hmm. You know how they say the political is personal. I mean, You embody that idea. You have your whole life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I wonder if you'd read us a little passage from your book. It's a very special day at the White House. You're there for a National Urban League celebration. You have fallen and hurt your ankle, but you're going to go out there and see Barack Obama take off in his helicopter anyway. It's a wonderful passage.
When the helicopter landed on the South Lawn, we were standing a safe but relatively close distance away. Now, of course, came the real excitement for my grandchildren. As the rotors beat up the wind, 7-year-old Matthew exclaimed, "It's like a hurricane!" He had experienced both Katrina and Rita in 2005. Shortly afterwards, President Obama came out of the West Wing, walked across the lawn, and waved to us as the children gleefully waved back. Before he boarded, he turned around and waved one more time. We then followed Admiral Rochon on the tour. Later during the Urban League's conference, Michelle, Kimma, Mason, Margot, Martine, and I had a private audience with President Obama. He greeted each of us warmly, and we chatted for a few minutes. I reflected back on Dutchess saying to a reporter that it wasn't possible for a Negro boy to even dream of becoming mayor. And here were Dutch's children and grandchildren meeting the President of the United States of America, who was black, like us. I was slightly self-conscious greeting the president from a wheelchair. After expressing how proud I was of him, I said pointedly, "You know, Mr. President, I broke my ankle at your house." He said, "I'm so sorry. You're not going to sue me, are you?" I smiled, "Of course not." It turned out to be that no bone was broken, but the ankle was so severely sprained that it was hard to tell. Whatever my injury, I was not suffering much pain at the moment. I was just grateful to be with the leader of the free world, and that world seemed a bit freer to me on that particular day.
Oh, that's so lovely. We've been talking with Sybil Morial, whose fascinating new memoir is Witness to Change from Jim Crow to Personal Empowerment. Sybil, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Angelou is one of our nation's most beloved poets, so much so that many school children learn such poems as "And Still I Rise," and "I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings," and "Phenomenal Woman." Let's hear some of the music inspired by her work. The group Decibella does a musical version of "I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings."
On the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of
And here's Angelou herself doing a lively spoken word performance of her poem, Human Family, from the album Cagebird Songs, recorded with hip-hop producer Rockstar.
Time for the preachers, the rabbis, the priests, pundits, and the professors to believe in the awesome wonder of diversity. It is time for parents to teach young people early on that in diversity there is beauty and there is strength. I note the obvious differences in the human family. Some of us are serious, some thrive on comedy. Some declare their lives are lived as true profundity, and others claim they really live the real reality. The variety of our skin tone can confuse, amuse, delight. Brown and pink and beige and purple, tan and blue and white. I've sailed upon the seven seas and stopped in every land. I've seen the wonders of the world, not yet one common man. I know 10,000 women called Jane and Mary Jane. I've not seen any two who really were the same. Mirror twins are different, although their features jive. And lovers think quite different thoughts while lying side by side. We love and lose in China. We weep on England's moors. We laugh and moan in Guinea and thrive on Spanish shores. We seek success in Finland, are born and die in Maine. In minor ways we differ, in major we're the same. I note the obvious differences between each sort and type, but we are more alike, my friend, than we are unalike. We are more alike, my friend, than we are unalike. We are more alike, my friend, than we are unalike. Our young must be taught that racial peculiarities do exist, but that beneath the skin, beyond the differing features, and into the true heart of being, fundamentally, we are more alike, my friend, than we are unalike. We all should know that diversity makes for a rich tapestry, and we must understand that all the threads of the tapestry are equal in value, no matter their color, equal in importance, no matter their texture.
Kelly Harris DeBerry is a New Orleans poet and literacy activist. She serves on the board of STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, and is the founder of the website brassybrown.com. Her latest poetry CD is called Revival, and today we'll be listening to her poem It's a Girl from that CD. Kelly and her husband, Jarvis DeBerry, have a gorgeous daughter, Naomi, and it will be interesting to see the poems Naomi inspires over the years to come. On a day when the Reading Life celebrates the lives of African American women, here is It's a Girl.
It's a girl. So hands pat her father's back to comfort him. A girl disappoints a man's dreams. A man's seed needs to be a boy, to carry the last name, to take to games. It's cheaper than bows and pink and dresses and bras and getting knocked up. They tell me every man wants one, gotta have a junior or a son to be a man, to be young again, to go fishing, get dirty, flex muscles, 'cause men are better with boys, but can't always make them. Imagine your father wondering why his why is a girl instead. Secretly sad, dads all over the world, from China to India, plan family patriarchy, and it's the women, too, who tell me at 6 months that girls are too much and boys are less stressed. Strangers are already planning my next time, overlooking the baby girl inside, because I've got to give my man a boy. Like it's my fault or his choice, as if I should return this girl like a shirt or a toaster and pop out a different ball of human, as if girl is second prize, like my womb is the lottery. All births are lucky prayers, so many unanswered. Fathers throwing tantrums while babies are born with cancer and tubes down their throats. And still, they shrug girls off their shoulders instead of carrying them high. Pardon me while I love my daughter without regret from my husband. We make love into person, dreaming only of her safety, giggles, and magic. In a world where little boys will demand she give them her ball by the age of 2. And this is only the beginning of pushing through darkness and tight spaces. Just to live. Just to live. Just to live.
That was poet Kelly Harris DeBerry reading the poem It's a Girl from her new spoken word CD, Revival. You can catch Kelly's next reading March 6th at 2 at the Alvar Branch Library. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Alan G. Gauthreau discusses Dark Bayou, Infamous Louisiana Homicides, Wednesday, January 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Dogfish Reading Series presents The Contributors to Mixed Company, an anthology featuring Addie Sitchens, Jerry Hill, Soraya Jean-Louis McElroy, Ambada Kazinance, J.R. Ramakrishnan, and Christina K. Robinson. Thursday, January 21st at 7:30 at 2448 North Fillory Street. Brian Bailey signs Embracing the Wild in Your Dog, Thursday, January 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Stuart Strum reads from his work, followed by an open mic, Sunday, January 24th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Elizabeth De Simone, a local author and teacher, will lead a writing seminar on creating vivid imagery. That's at 7 on Tuesday, January 26th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.